Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, remembering the Harlem riots sparked by a shooting 50 years ago today.
What the Negro in the Harlems are fighting for is what's good for all of America, the working people of America. All you have to do is to look at the statistics nationwide when it comes to unemployment, when it comes to people who are living in poverty.
Sound from the WNYC archives from July 1964. More coming up. But first, the story you're about to hear is not from, say, Mississippi in the 1960s. It's from New York City today. As reported in a New York Times investigation, it's a story of rampant, systematic, ongoing brutality by corrections officers at Rikers Island against inmates who are mentally ill. We will let the reporters tell their own story. They are Michael Weinrip and Michael Schwartz. Thanks to both of you for coming on WNYC.
Thank you for having us.
Your article opens with the stories of Jose Bautista and Andre Lane. Can you start briefly with how they came to be beaten by corrections officers?
In Bautista's case, he was very upset. He decided he was going to hang himself. He was in a holding pen, took his underwear, shredded it, put it around his neck. And before he could finish the act, several corrections officers rushed over, grabbed him down. But instead of calling medical care, which is what they're supposed to do in that case, what they're trained to do, they put him on the ground. And when he moved quickly, I don't know if they panicked or were angry, and they just started wrestling with him and punching him, and it perforated his lower bowel, and he almost died.
And Andre Lane?
And Andre Lane was one of a number of inmates in a punitive segregation unit, so solitary confinement designed for mentally ill inmates. And there had been some problems, some delays with dinner. There was a possibility they weren't going to get some dinner. Some words were exchanged with correction officers. And he and another inmate, Tamal Dixon, were extracted from their cells, handcuffed to gurneys, brought to a medical unit where medical staff were present. And a number of COs proceeded to beat them savagely, even as medical personnel begged them to stop.
And you have a video on your site that we have linked to of Andre Lane talking to you. Listeners, if you want to see it, go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. And here's an excerpt in which he describes this altercation with officers from his point of view after he says they refused him food.
They get me up, they put me in cuffs, they leave me on the desk, and they start punching me in my face. Boom, punching me in my face, jabbing me in my face, crazy. They got me outside the B gate. When they got me outside the B gate, they brought the stretcher. I was fighting to get on the stretcher. I didn't want to get on the stretcher. When I was fighting, One of the officers just jabbed me both ways. Bing, bing. The lieutenant came and was like, yo, stop resisting. How can I be resisting when I'm cuffed to the gurney? How can I be resisting? My teeth is all bloody. My mouth is all bloody. I got blood all down my throat and blood from my head to my feet. I was bloodied up. They said if I would have lost a lot of more blood, a little bit more blood, I would die. I probably would have went in cardiac arrest.
Andre Lane, one of 129 people at Rikers Island who a report from the New York City Health and Mental Health Department acknowledged were beaten by corrections officers last year. How does his telling of the story change the context of your story? It sounds like guards weren't just picking on people for sick, violent thrills or something like that, but more like an overreaction to his trying to resist in some way being subdued.
Certainly. In a number of these cases, the inmates are not completely innocent. Andre Lane, for instance, threw some kind of liquid, possibly urine, at the correction officers, and as you can imagine, they became very, very angry. In a number of cases that we looked at, a number of cases out of this 129, the inmates did something to set the correction officers off. But what resulted is in numerous cases, time and again, was an overwhelming use of force against these inmates that led to sometimes very, very serious injuries.
And brought into question the lack of professionalism among the correction officers. The correction officers, they're not street brawlers. They're taught to use certain techniques and certain responses, not to get react violently to taunts. And it almost became a street fighting situation.
So, listeners, our guest did a four-month investigation for the New York Times. Among other things, they uncovered what I mentioned briefly before, a Department of Health and Mental Hygiene report on corrections officer violence at Rikers that the city had refused to make public, and it detailed 129 incidents from last year alone, Jose Bautista's and Andre Lane's being among the most serious. Listeners, if you have any connection to this story, we would love to hear from you. Any corrections officers listening right now who want to tell this from your point of view, talk about the larger context of life at Rikers as a corrections officer, anybody who has been an inmate there or is one right now, we know people do listen behind bars, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or any lawyers, social workers, advocates, teachers, anybody, family members with a story to tell here about the treatment of mentally ill inmates at Rikers Island, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Michael Weinrip and Michael Schwartz, our guests, the two New York Times reporters who did this four-month investigation. Michael Weinrip, tell us more about this report.
The report looked closely at 129 cases where inmates suffered serious injuries. And so one of the interesting parts is it didn't matter in a way who started the altercation. The result was an inmate being brutally beaten, which raised the question, what could you do to deserve that kind of beating? And the report talked about how 80% of the inmates reported having been beaten after they were handcuffed. More than half reported that they were stopped or when they tried to get medical care because COs threatened them. And even five cases, there were cases like Batista's case where people tried to hang themselves and were beaten after that.
And your article says the report paints, quote, a damning portrait of guards on Rikers Island. But then you seem to lay the blame not on sadistic guards, although some of what you just said would seem to indicate the degree of sadism, but on poor training. Officers poorly equipped to deal with mental illness, you write, who instead respond with overwhelming force to even minor provocations. So, Michael Schwartz, is this primarily about inadequate training?
That's debatable right now. The correction officers receive about 38.5 hours of training at the academy before they get on the job. And this is augmented by some refresher courses annually. The correction department wants to add 8 hours to that, but both the correction officers union and others feel that's inadequate. And so the issue becomes, you know, what should be the purpose of correction officers? Should they be also taking on the roles of psychologists? Should they be taking on the roles of counselors? Or should they be should they solely be responsible for security? And should the mission of the jail change to one that brings in more personnel who would be responsible for these activities, for counseling, for psychology?
What does the city say in response to that question? And what does the Corrections Officers Union say?
Well, the city appears to believe that more mental health programs should be brought into the correction department. The mayor recently approved, I think it's $32 million for additional mental health programs. That includes additional correction officers, but it also includes money for therapy programs for mentally ill inmates at the jails.
And what you do acknowledge, Michael Weinrip, that this is all taking place amid a surge of inmate violence the last 5 years. Inmates attacking other inmates, attacking corrections officers, attacking civilian staff, and that two-thirds of such attacks are committed by mentally ill inmates. So how much does that complicate the context of a damning portrait of the corrections officer as the primary story here?
Well, when the correction officer says the correction office is not equipped to work at a psychiatric hospital, and that's essentially what Rikers has become. There are as many mentally ill people at Rikers as there are at all 24 New York State psychiatric hospitals.
That is an unbelievable stat, and I really stopped in my tracks, although I was already sitting down, when I read it in your piece. And so I'm just going to repeat it because this is something people should know. 4,000 of the 11,000 inmates at Rikers have mental illness diagnoses, and that 4,000, what you just said, is more people than in all the New York State psychiatric hospitals combined. So now we know what mentally ill housing means in New York State, a nice warm prison bed with poorly trained guards. And now, thanks to your story, we know some of the worst consequences of allowing mentally ill New Yorkers to fall into crime, a high risk of being beaten at Rikers.
And so one of the issues is a correction officer, because of privacy rules, if I were working in that kind of environment, I would want to know if an inmate is off his medication, if you had an inmate who has schizophrenia and he's off his medication. But because of privacy laws, they're not allowed to know that, the HIPAA laws. And that puts a correction officer at a disadvantage. Now, it doesn't justify the kind of brutality we wrote about. And often the brutality involved three or four correction officers to one inmate. But it is problematic to have law enforcement people who are trying to deal with such a large mentally ill population.
Let's take a phone call. I think we have a corrections officer from Rikers Island on his way to work. Patrick, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Hi, Brian. I was just driving and listening. Great show as usual. Thank you. Just have to say that someone had it right a few minutes ago, and I didn't catch the name of the person, who said we have so many mentally ill inmates that it's now a facility for the mentally ill. And it's not only the attacks from the mentally ill inmates, it's the attack from inmates on inmates, then inmates on correction officers. In my facility, in the past 3-4 weeks, I'll need more than two hands to count the amount of officers that were attacked by inmates. So I can understand an overreaction or something, but in other cases, when there's 5-6 inmates attacking one officer, when you go in, you have to use force, and these inmates don't stop when you say stop resisting. It's never stop resisting, and they stop resisting. They're going all out.
Patrick, what do you need as a corrections officer? What does the system need?
The training is so inadequate. Then secondly, we are always understaffed. You try working a mentally ill ward understaffed and see how that works. I don't know what the policy is for NYPD when they are punched in the face. What should the policy be for a correction officer who's punched in the face? Stand back and wait. That's the policy.
Stand back and wait. Stand back and get yourself out of harm's way.
Your job is to maintain the safe order of the facility to protect DOC staff and inmates. And when inmates attack staff, you're trained not to go in and react immediately, but your natural instinct is to go in and react immediately. Now, some people do overreact. I give you that, but that's not all the time, and that's not all the cases.
Michael Weiner,
I'd like to ask Patrick. Use of force is way, way up at Rikers, 90% more than it was just 5 years ago. And Class A, which, as you know, is the most dramatic use of force, is also way, way up. And it's even in the last 6 months. How does that all fit in? How do you think about that?
So I understaffing. Have you looked at the number of staff that has been compared to 6 years ago or even 5 years ago, 4 years ago? Now, the policy now is you cannot – force is out the window. Nobody even wants to use force unless it's absolutely necessary. Because we all go into work and want to leave the work the same way we went in. Nobody goes to work just to use force. That's not the case. You go to work, you try to do your job, then you get urine thrown in your face.
Patrick, thank you very much for calling in. good luck out there. Either of you want to respond or react to anything more? I mean, you hear the, you know, the plaintiff plea from the corrections officer's standpoint there.
Certainly. And you know, one of the things that we didn't touch on a lot in this story is you know, some of the violence, particularly in general population areas. There continue to be gangs. There continue to be gang rivalries that erupt into explosive violence at Rikers Island. And this is something the COs, correction officers, have to deal with. I would dispute, though, the idea of understaffing being at the heart of a lot of this. You know, yes, it is true that the number of correction officers has declined over the last 5 years or so, but that comes as the inmate population itself is declining dramatically and has declined dramatically over the last two decades.
And one of the things that's also striking, we go to city council meetings where we sit there for 5 hours and board of corrections meetings for three hours over the last several months, and they talk about violence. And it's absolutely true. They talk about inmate-on-inmate violence. They talk about inmate-on-correction officer violence. They talk about inmate-on-staff violence. But they never, ever talk about correction officer-on-inmate violence. It's the undiscussed it's peculiar that it never comes up.
And you even suggest cover-ups in your article of some of these incidents. How so?
Well, a number of these cases. So, what happens after a use of force incident? So, when a correction officer uses force against an inmate, there's supposed to be a report that is filed. Every incident has a report, and the incident is classified as either A, B, or C. A being the most violent episodes, but oftentimes, in particular, in the cases that we looked into, these use of force reports, the extent of the injuries was played down. Some crucial details were left out. In Andre Lane's case, for instance, it was labeled a Class B use of force, which is kind of a midway point. And if you kind of look at the extent of his injuries, you have to wonder what the classification system, whether it's adequately describing what is going on.
In other words, they made it sound like a more serious act of violence on his part than it actually was?
Well, even more so, they didn't even mention that there was violence on the correction officer's part. The incident report on that describes him as, after they got him out of the cell, as wheeling him down into the clinic, and everything went normal there. There was no use of force. He was beaten brutally there.
212-433-WNYC. If anyone else wants to join the conversation from personal experience or just with a question or comment, 212-433-9692. For two New York Times reporters, Michael Schwartz and Michael Weinrip, who did this unbelievable four-month investigative report, which was published yesterday, on large numbers of cases of correction officer brutality against mentally ill inmates at Rikers Island. I'm still thinking about the caller, the corrections officer named Patrick, and the no-win situation that he says he's in when an incident begins, like an inmate punching him in the face or throwing urine at him. You mention in your article San Francisco as offering a good model for change. Is there some other kind of training or some other kind of response mechanism that takes place in San Francisco that we could learn from in New York?
One thing that we discovered when we talked to some officials from San Francisco is the high level of communication that you have between the mental health side and the correction officer's side. And so there you have the head of corrections and the head of mental health. They're working hand in hand. They're communicating daily. And that starts at the top. And then they have daily meetings among line staff to discuss problem inmates, to discuss potential pitfalls that they can expect to have during the shift. Here you have a very contentious relationship right now between the mental health side and the correction side. When we talk to mental health staff, they're in kind of a difficult position because they're reliant solely upon the correction officers for security in sometimes violent situations. Many of them are hesitant to bring up cases of abuse for fear that they may provoke retaliation by correction officers. Correction officers also blame the mental health side for undermining security in their efforts to provide counseling and therapy for these individuals.
And in New York, the thing that's different is not only is the it's not the corrections department so much, it's the correction officers union that is at war with the health department. And unless you get some cooperation, the only way the culture there is going to change is if the correction officers and their union change, and if they find some way to make peace with the health department and the department that deals with the mentally ill. And right now there is no cooperation.
John in Brooklyn, another corrections officer calling in. John, thank you very much. You're on the air.
You're very welcome, and thank you for taking my call. I've been listening, and I just wanted to say that there's two factors that I haven't heard discussed so far. The first of which are the conditions in which correction officers work. Just to make the general public aware, if it's 80 degrees outside, a correction officer, usually in Rikers Island, is working in about 100-degree temperature. They have to wear vests that are insulated to protect them themselves, but it also creates heat. You have to wait a half hour before you even go to your station place in hot hallways that can reach over 100 degrees. So correction officers have rotating off days. There's no set real schedule. You're told 10 minutes before you're getting ready to walk out the door, you have to do another shift. And then you're put into these circumstances where you go into a facility where there's an inmate who's already irritable from maybe not having his needs being addressed from another officer whose shift you're relieving. And then this transfers from one officer to the next. And if you're doing a 17-hour shift in a facility that is heated over 100 degrees temperature, and then someone is irate, upset, possibly understandably upset, it just makes for a mix of bad things to happen. Now, as far as the physical abuse that I can say, there's a little thing on Rikers Island that goes around amongst a lot of inmates where they file lawsuits against officers regularly. And it's sort of a condition. If you, great example, if you approach a cop on the street and you yell at a cop can arrest you. If you spit on a cop, that's assault on an officer. The correction officer has none of these recourses. In fact, the courts tend to favor the side of inmates. So officers know this, inmates know this, and it's this back and forth of words that often escalate. And just so that the listeners and the interviewers for the Times are aware, if you have one officer in a facility with 45 inmates who have been separated from other inmates because their behavior is already irate, and they technically haven't been labeled as having a mental diagnosis, you know, when one altercation erupts, you're surrounded by these inmates. So when you hear of officers overreacting after the fact, it's easy to point to that and say it's an abuse of physical force when you are not aware of the conditions that they were forced to exist.
John, I'm going to leave it there because we're running out of time, but thank you very much. Both of the corrections officer callers have mentioned kind of different standards for corrections officers versus NYPD officers. Maybe different training, the first one was talking about, if somebody splashes urine in their face was the example that he gave. He talks about different protections under the law for what an officer may do to react in situations like this. Is this an issue that needs to be dealt with?
Well, it is a problem. There's no question about that. But the flip side is correction officers are really rarely prosecuted. In the cases we looked at over and over, we've looked at cases where that have been ruled homicides by the medical examiner where no one has ever prosecuted. So it is very, very rare that a correction officer is taken through the criminal prosecution system.
Let me just wrap this up with one sort of underlying question and an observation. These incidents were in 2013. From this health department report in the Bloomberg administration's last year. Now we have the de Blasio administration. This is more coming to light now, and the mayor has created a task force specifically to deal with the issue of mental illness at Rikers, and he has ended the use of solitary confinement for seriously mental ill inmates. So this is apparently on their radar screen. But Michael Weinrib, you've been reporting on mental health and housing for the mentally ill for many, many years. Do we need to look at the underlying failure to create tracks for low-income, mentally ill New Yorkers other than those that would wind up with them committing crimes in the first place that land them at Rikers instead of on some more positive track?
Yes. There's no question there's not enough community housing, but it's more complicated than that. When I wrote about this 15 years ago, there was so little community housing that the people who were getting into the community housing who were mentally ill were relatively high functioning. Today, a lot of these people, we need some sort of middle ground where a very difficult person who's mentally ill, who can be violent, where there's some sort of housing program for that person, and we don't have that right now.
And going back, what, 40 years, 50 years to the 1960s when the deinstitutionalization movement started, and that was seen as a mentally ill person's rights movement to get them out of the old psychiatric hospitals. Now such, and nobody wants to see mass institutionalization of people just on the basis of being mentally ill, but unfortunately it seems like the upshot of it has been a transfer, in statistical terms, of a lot of those people from what were psychiatric hospitals to what is now a psychiatric prison.
That's correct.
We interviewed a mother of a son who'd spent 3 years committed to a psychiatric hospital. Now, your knee-jerk reaction is, oh, it's a snake pit. Why do you want someone there? But when he went out, he was in a housing program. He severely beat one of the counselors. He was put out of the program. He was arrested for robbery, petty robbery, involving cell phones. And once he got into Rikers and acted out, he was brutally beaten. So, you know, we've gone full circle.
And that's something that we should, you know, really underline. In case after case, yes, there were some that were in Rikers for violent crimes, but I would say a good chunk of those were in Rikers Island for nonviolent crimes, for parole violation, for thefts, for trespassing.
And why didn't the health department want its own report on this horror show at Rikers out? They even refused you under a Freedom of Information Act request, and I guess you had to get it through some other underground channels.
To be honest, there was no reason that report should not have been released. There were no names in that report. They were just trends and statistical trends. And I don't understand why they didn't. I think it was improper.
We'll see if the article produces change. Incredibly powerful. That hit the New York Times website 2 nights ago, the paper yesterday, and is still up there. And, of course, we have a link to it on our site, also to the video that accompanies it at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Reporters Michael Weinrip, Michael Schwartz, thank you both very much.
Thank you for having us.